Thank you, sir.
I'm glad you're here.
I would just like to sit and listen to Sherry talk about me. I mean, it's a... Thank you so much, Sherry. And thank you, Sonia. I love your music. You know, God sings his song through you. It's beautiful. My name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. My group is a Markham Village group in Markham, Ontario. I have a sponsor, Clancy. I sponsor people, and I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like to thank Dick and Barbara for having this again this year. It's just, I've been here a few years, and it's just kind of unique. I just love it. It's really special. And I know there's a lot of work goes into it. And, you know, I think that they just deserve a bit of applause for doing this thing. I would also like to thank Lee for the service you always provide for us, Lee. Thank you so much. And I would like to thank Steve, who came to the airport at 11 o'clock on Thursday night to pick me up. He went to Annie Lentz. And... thank you so much, Steve, for picking me up. It's a good service. And so I am here to speak about step four. You know, step four to me is, step four, five, and six, what they are like to me is they're the pre-op. They're the pre-op preparation before the soul surgery that goes on in step seven. Because in step seven, we're asking for things to be removed, the things that have been blocking us. And step four is the beginning for me of a lifetime process. I'll tell you how I did step four the first time. I had a slip. And after being a few months in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had called my sponsor at the time and blamed her. And she fired me. And I remember going into my group, the people in Edmonton, Alberta, where I got sober, they just loved me. And, you know, even after my slip, they were with me all the time. And, you know, I was in really bad shape. After that, they told me I was shaking so much, strangers were waving back at me. And I was sitting in the meeting shaking. And the day after my slip, a little gal had spent the night with me and given service, and she'd done the third step with me. And something very profound happened to me during that third step process. And I'm not doing the third step because it was covered very beautifully by our last speaker. And so something so profound happened to me. I got a sense of mea culpa, that everything I had ever done or everything I had suffered, losing my children, losing my femininity, losing my humanity, having lived on the street, everything that I'd ever done and had happened to me was my fault. And I truly believe that that was just a little period of grace I had. And I wanted this thing with every fiber of my being. I desired it. And after people spending days with me and being with me, and because I was coming off a lot of medication, I spent a lot of time in mental institutions. And from my dry date, the 10th of August, 1984, I had never, ever had any more medication. But they all stayed with me to make sure that nothing happened to me. That was my choice. I'm not a doctor. I'm not prescribing for anybody. It was my choice. And then I got shingles. And I'm lying in bed, and a thought came to me, why don't you do your fourth step? And the wisdom in Edmonton, Alberta at the time was that before you do your fourth step, you make an appointment to do your fifth step. Because too many times people have been caught drunk carrying around their four-step in their back pocket. At that time, I still had a great trouble with trust. I felt that a lot of you in the rooms had never been where I'd been and seen what I'd seen. There was a certain arrogance to how far down I'd gone. You know, I thought the rest of you were just toast burners, you know. But you know, I had the basic pathological, fearless, fearful person I was. I just didn't trust. I had a problem with trust. There was a Jesuit priest in the program who was in recovery, and he also heard Fifth Steps. So I called him. His parish was downtown Edmonton, and I made an appointment. And then I remember reading about Bill sitting with a piece of yellow foolscap when he was doing these steps, and Bill was my hero, and I got a piece of yellow foolscap. And with shingles, no medication, I prayed to God. And you know, at that time, because I was in this state of grace, that's mea culpa, I couldn't think of resentments that first time, because it was all my fault. So when I was reading Bill, I think he said on page 73, that we wouldn't get well until we told somebody all of our life story. So what I did was I started writing my life story. The reason being that long before I drank, I had been morally bankrupt, spiritually bankrupt, emotionally bankrupt. Because you see, my problem was that I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and I'd never had a drink yet. Nobody ever taught me to be a liar, a cheat, and a thief. It just came natural. My stealing started at age 7. It began with an apple. I was born in 1943, and our food in Scotland was rationed until 1952. And when I was 7, the Americans, that's you, had sent big crates of beautiful apples to our school. And I'd never had such a big, red, shiny apple. And I remember eating this apple. And already I wanted more. And because nobody would give me theirs, I decided to find out where they put it, those that didn't eat it. And I went out to the cloakroom and I stole apples from people's pockets who were saving them for later, who didn't have the need for immediate gratification that I did. So just like Eve in the Garden of Eden, I started with an apple. Also at that time I had been stealing money from my grandma and stealing money from my mother, and my mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. My father had been a Franciscan monk who had left the monastery, not for any bad reason, just a theological dispute. So I was taught nothing except about how to be a good girl, and I just didn't have any capacity for it. You know, and I remember my granny saying to my mother, when she has her first Holy Communion, she'll be a good girl. And when I had my first Holy Communion, my veil flew out the window and I stole somebody else's so I wouldn't get into trouble. So it went on from there. And lying, just because you see, there's a wonderful essay that Bill Wilson has written. It's called This Matter of Fear. And in that essay, he talks about the pathological feelings of being inferior, of being insecure, of just feeling he was not as good as the rest of the world. And his fear became so overwhelming that in the end, he became aggressive. You see, we go from fearful to overly aggressive. When I was in the mental institution the last time, the wonderful psychiatrist who'd been looking after me for 4 years, he said to me, you know, we've given you all these diagnoses, but initially you are a chronic alcoholic. And chronic alcoholics have abnormal personalities. There's just something wrong with a lot of you, but we don't really understand it. And he said, I'm going to send you for assertiveness training. I said, I don't need assertiveness training. I'm in here because I tried to kill my husband. He said, alcoholics don't have enough self-esteem to be assertive. They're aggressive. You people are so neurotic and so paranoid and filled with fear that you become aggressive. But way deep down, it's because of your deep, deep fear. And that was so true. So I sat down and I started writing out all this stuff. And I always loved Carl Jung. And I remember reading Carl Jung. He was doing a quotation from the Gospels of St. Thomas. And the quotation was this: if you bring out what is within you, what you bring out will save you. If you do not bring out what is within you, then what you do not bring out will destroy you. And I related that to the fourth step. That is exactly what was going on with me, because you see, I had tried time after time after time after time not to drink. And I couldn't. I could not drink. Why? There's a beautiful line from Moby Dick that I love. You know Moby Dick? When I feel myself going grim about the mouth, when I feel the cold November wind chill blowing through my soul, and I feel myself wanting to walk out onto the street and knock people's hats off, then I know it's time to go to sea. For me, then I know it's time for a drink. And I did not want that to happen to me again. Because my line in this book, more about alcoholism, is the idea that someday, somehow, I will enjoy and control my drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Some of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. I had already done that. The only thing I hadn't done was die. I wanted to die. I tried to die. But you see, we laugh at it. But I wanted to die, but I didn't want to hurt myself. That is true. I wanted to drink myself slowly into oblivion. But I was the living dead. And you know, when it says in this book again, if we don't do this stuff, you know, if we drink again, we will die. I always say, you wish. Some of us live forever drinking. We do not die easy. But what we die to is the spirit, the soul. We are dead spiritually. So I have to get down to the causes and the conditions that were blocking me from God's. Because you see, the third step is a vital and crucial step. But it won't have any effect whatsoever if I don't have a strenuous effort to get down to the things that had been blocking me. Step three will just be a decision. That's all it will be. And I knew from listening that if I did not do this step and then go on to the fifth, I would drink again. Because this thing that I am entering into and the thing that I have always fought against and the thing that Don spoke about so beautifully is this escape from self. That's what it was always for me before I drank. You see, I had this unbearable, unsheddable burden of self. An unsheddable terrible burden of self-consciousness that everywhere I went, I thought everybody was looking at me and judging me and finding me not enough. It was a self that I was absolutely claustrophobic within me. And I've never heard it described as well as I did by a poet called Anne Sexton, who died of alcohol-related problems. She committed suicide. And she said, "I have a body and I cannot escape from it. I would like to fly out of my mind, but it is out of the question. It is written in the tablet of human destiny that I am stuck here in this human form. That being so, I'd like to call attention to my problem." All my life before I drank, I was trying to call attention to my problem. I'm stuck in self. I'm claustrophobic. I'm my own self-contained ecosystem. How can I get out of self? I don't know how to get out of self. And it used to give me panic attacks, just like Bill. It used to give me this obsession with death, just like Bill. And I was always looking for people to understand and help me. Can you help me? Now, I didn't know a drink would help me. I didn't know a drink would relieve me from the consciousness of this never-ending consciousness of self, this isolating factor. I remember when I went out with my first date. And at the end of the night, I don't know if you're like that in this, here where we are now, Georgia, but in Scotland, when you go out with somebody, at the end of a night, they want a reward. And I remember, at the end of the night, being with this fellow in Scotland, and, he's getting very passionate, and I'm just kept there kind of observing him, you know, thinking about myself, and at the height of his passion, I said to him, "So what do you think about death?" Because no matter who's in my life, I'm thinking about me, because I'm trying to keep myself together. I knew that if I did not do this, I would not be able to bear the consciousness of daily living. Because of all the things I had done, I was age 40 when I came in here. I had lost my children, and my heart has never, ever healed. My mother and father were both dead by the time I got to AA. My father died walking out in the street thinking about me at 3 o'clock in the morning, not knowing where I was. My mother died of ovarian cancer. My last talk to her was on the phone drunk. I had done so many things. I had hurt so many people. I'd done things that I knew I'd never tell anybody. And if I could never tell anybody, then I'd have to drink, because it's the only way I had any forgetting, oblivion. I need oblivion to live. That's why I love being in the mental institutions, because for a while they treated me as a manic depressive, and they'd give me all the yum-yums. The lithium, the valium, the librium, the yum-yums. And I would get oblivion. I would get oblivion. So, I did all of this. This is the way I did my first. And I went down to the priest. And it was downtown Edmonton. And Edmonton has, right downtown, there's some big, big buildings, and there's a lot of it in shadow. And for many years, I had been walking in shadows. I was so ashamed of my life. I was so ashamed of myself. I was so ashamed of the things that had happened to me. My life on Skid Row was like going through a sewer in a glass-bottom boat. And I never thought I could lift up my head again. I never thought I could walk in the sunshine again. But I am so grateful for the gift I was given, the gift of willingness to have this at any cost. You see, I had this burning desire to get rid of this stuff from within me, that I would be able to go on and do the things I had to do in the steps to get to be like you. Because I saw what was happening with you and I wanted what you had. You looked free to me. And this was all in these halcyon days of my early sobriety. And I went down to that priest and I sat and I read out this stuff that I never thought I'd tell anybody. Things that my darling mother and my darling father would never believe I had done. That wasn't even within their imagination, I don't believe. And I had had no conscience about doing. All that moral stuff came whenever I stopped drinking. When I'm drinking, I don't have a moral code. I will do anything when I'm drinking. I used to go into Kingston Penitentiary in Ontario, which is a maximum security prison. And I remember this fellow telling me that he woke up one day in jail and he'd been in a blackout and he thought he just had the normal stuff in a fight with a policeman. And he'd killed his wife and daughter. And he was never coming out. And I think, my God, that could have been me. That's the wonderful thing you get from doing this fourth and fifth. You get to see it could have been me. You got to walk in somebody else's moccasin. You begin to develop empathy and compassion. You begin to even think about yourself a wee bit better than you were. Because that priest said to me, Mari, you were not a bad person trying to be good. You were a very sick person and now you're trying to get well. And I thought that this priest would be so ashamed of me. And he wasn't. And he reminded me how these steps came about. He reminded me, he said, these are God-given gift to Bill Wilson. And then he spoke about Father Ed Dowling, who was a Jesuit. And I don't know if you remember the little story, Bill is up in his office and he's in one of his depressions. And the janitor comes and said, there's an old drunk here to see you. He looks like he's in bad shape because he was stumbling. And Bill says, send him up. Because Bill was in depression, thinking about himself. And Father Ed came up and when he took off his coat, he saw he had on a collar. And Father Ed said to Bill, where did you get these steps from? And Bill said, they just came to me. And Father Ed says, do you realize that these are very closely aligned to the disciplines of Ignatius Loyola? Exercises that the Jesuits take on a yearly basis for transformation. So I knew that I was on the road of transformation here. The priest asked me if I'd told him absolutely everything. I had told him just about absolutely everything. And he went outside to go and get a cup of tea or something. And he said, you just leave me alone for a minute. And then he came back in. And again, I got that, I believe it's a gift. If I come out of here and don't share these last couple of things that were related, I will drink again. I just believed I would, because they were the worst things in my inventory. things that you think you can never tell another human being. And I told him. And he said, let's say some prayers. Now you've left this stuff here. He said, and when we finish praying, I want you to go home. Put this big book, because I had my big book with me, put it on the shelf, and then take it off again. He says, you seem to be somebody who likes ritual. And I said, I was. And he said, he asked me if I was feeling shame and humiliation at that point. I had been feeling shame and humiliation when I went in. But after completing this exercise, it was like he had exercised the shame and the humiliation. He'd taken it from me, which is, I think, what happens with our sponsors. They take it from us. This admission of all these things to another human being, I am amazed at how many people don't want to do it because of fear. Or because they think nobody will understand. There is nothing you can tell us, or me as a sponsor, that I haven't heard before. There's only so many things, as my sponsor said once, there's only so many things you can do with your body. You know, and I mean, we hear everything. We hear about everything. And this step is very necessary for ego deflation. Isn't it strange that people, someone like me, who has such low self-esteem, who absolutely thinks that I'm just worse than everybody else, who absolutely thinks that... In Scotland, when I used to fight with some people, because I was always fighting with people, because, you know, I was so weird that nobody liked me very much, and I was so fearful that in the end, if they didn't look like they liked me, I'd just punch them. And I remember them saying to me, "You're just a waste of good skin." And I remember feeling like I was just a waste of good skin, you know. And yet we have this ego, low self-esteem and inflated ego. That is bizarre. You know. Anyway, it comes back. That ego comes back. You know. So anyway, I did what he said I should do, and I went home and I took out my book and I went over to make sure that everything was all right. That everything was in place the way it tells you in the big book. And then step 6. Am I ready to have God remove all these defects of character? Am I ready? Well, again, in the halcyon days of my early sobriety, when I was given this gift of grace by God, because that's what I believe, I was ready to do anything. You know, to have the desire to do all of this with no reservations. There is no spiritual Viagra. You cannot create desire for this stuff. This desire comes from a place of brokenness, despair, and hopelessness. The brokenness, despair, and hopelessness that William James spoke about in the Varieties of Religious Experience. And it's such a spiritual thing we have. And the way we have been given it is, I don't know if you know this, but in 1906, I think it was 1900, Sigmund Freud was invited to speak at Clark University in America. And he brought his acolyte with him, Carl Jung. Carl Jung was still his acolyte. And this thing that Jung had been asked, Freud had been asked to speak at, William James had just come from Edinburgh in Scotland, giving the Gifford Lectures on the varieties of religious experience. That's what they came from. And William James and Jung started to talk. And he spoke about, amongst other things, alcohol. Well, they didn't call it alcoholism then, but this strange thing that we have. And he shared with William James, and William James shared with him about the group of drunks he'd investigated, who'd been skid row bums, hopeless, written off by their family, winos he called them, sots, no future ahead of them. And almost overnight, they had become upstanding members of their community. And when he asked every one of them, he found the common denominator was hopelessness and despair, and being able to talk to each other about the things that had gone on. That is what has filtered down to us. Because I don't know any alcoholic who doesn't have this burden of guilt and despair and self-hate from doing things that we never ever thought we would do. We didn't want to do it. I didn't want to drink and do all the things I did. Drink and lose my children. Drink and get into the life of immorality that I had gotten into. I didn't want to do any of that. But I am an alcoholic. And it seems to me that this soul surgery, because the old timers used to say that what we have is a soul sickness. And I believe that. I believe that to be true. So this spiritual work that we do, this thing of the spirit, I'm doing it so that I never have to drink spirit ever again. So that dictum from Jung, spiritus contra spiritum, spirit against spirit, that's what it's all about. For some reason, I am one of those that William James spoke about when he said there are six souls who have to be born again. They have to be twice born. I am one of those who had to be twice born. And I think that the baptismal water for me was liquor. Because if liquor hadn't worked for me, I would have spent the rest of my life, I believe, either in an institution or heavily medicated for the rest of my life. That is what I believe. So that was how I went through my first goings in with the fourth and fifth. It's a lifetime job, so eventually I knew I would, because what happened was, after that original beautiful thing of mea culpa, I love everybody. I have no resentments. It was all my fault. All my fault, God. Nobody else. I forgive all my ex-husbands. You know? So then, I start living in the now. I start living on a daily basis. I have a sponsor. My first sponsor was Carol in Edmonton. And then I start going to a lot of meetings. And after a few months, I start thinking about my first husband that I had forgiven. What is the true nature of forgiveness? Because I would say, well, I forgive him, but I'll never forget. That's not forgiveness, right? And then I think about other stuff, about my family in Scotland, about the teachers I used to have, about the people that never truly understood me, you know, about everybody that did me wrong. And then I'm getting to a place in my first year of sobriety where I love AA, and I'm still doing everything I have to do, but all of that stuff before wasn't my fault. Wasn't my fault. So I talked to Carol. Carol said, well, I think you've got some resentments you have to look at. And I did it the way she said here, and the way in the book, in the four columns. And then I started seeing resentment was the number one offender. I had been granted a little bit of grace where I hadn't seen that, but suddenly now I see it. And you see, the resentments I used to have were not resentments, they were hate. I hated. I didn't know the word resentment. I realized I'd had a lot of hate in my heart because of the feelings of difference I'd had and blaming everybody for my life. And I went through the book the way it says here. Clancy, my second sponsor when I moved to Toronto was a woman called Renee D. Renee died with 53 years sobriety. And when I was about 8 years sober, I found out that my two sons had been put out of their father's house in Jamaica and were living with their old grandmother. And Renee said to me, it's time to go back. So we went through the steps again, and she said, it's time to go back to Jamaica. Because she got me up to 8 and 9, she said, and make amends to the island. And I became full of fear again, absolutely paranoid with fear. I thought, if I go back to Jamaica, that's where I started drinking. I'm going to drink again. It was from Jamaica I went and ended up on the street in Miami. I'm going to end up on the street again. I'm going to end up in a mental institution. I was riddled with fear about this move at 8 years sobriety. And Renee said to me, look, honey, I've never been in a mental institution. Right? But I know somebody who, I've never been on the street, but I know somebody who has, and his name's Clancy. She said, when you get to Jamaica, call Clancy. And the job I had at the time was flying up and down to the States. So I called Clancy when I got to Montego Bay. And he said to me, write a little bit about your life and fax it to me. That's how long ago this was. So I sat down and wrote him my life story, more or less. And then a little while later, the phone rang. And he said, Mary, it's Clancy. And I thought, oh my God, he's read this and I'm too sick for him. And he said, I thought I should ring you and tell you this immediately. After reading this, I thought it was very urgent that I called you. I've got to tell you this. I said, what? He said, you really shouldn't drink. And he was wonderful to me, and because I really thought I was going to drink again at that stage at 8 years. I just felt overwhelmed, and he saved my life. And one time I flew up to Delray Beach, and he was there speaking, and he'd rented a car. We were just talking about it. And he drove me around there's a space, what's it called?
Cape Canaveral.
Yeah. Thank you, darling. He drove me around Cape Canaveral, and I was doing my fifth step, a mini fifth. I did a mini fifth with Clancy in his car. And afterwards, he had to go and get his ear syringed. And no, really, I thought he was pulling my leg, but I think he needed that before he heard my step. But anyway. You know, it's a wonderful thing to have this freeness, but I truly believe, I live my life the way I was sponsored, and I sponsor the way I was sponsored. And I'll tell you, there's a situation came up a couple of times when I've had to go through these steps again. And I truly believe every now and then in going through all these steps again. It's just the way that I was sponsored, and it's just what I believe. But I'll tell you about something. I thought I had done everything there was to do in the fourth and fifth step. I thought there was nothing left for me to do. The rest was all just maintenance, maintenance, maintenance. But I'll tell you a situation that happened to me. And this is about 5 years ago. So I was about, 28 years sober? So I was working for this woman that God had put in my life to test my serenity. And she used to throw files at me. You know, she'd get upset and she'd throw files at me. And because I was in my AA mode of behavior, I used to say to her, "You really shouldn't do that. You'll just upset yourself." When really I could see myself visually taking the file, wrapping it around her scrawny little neck, and just waiting for a click. So anyway, I put up with 4 years of this behavior. And I was talking to my sponsor at that time. Clancy had told me to get Norma when I had my kids back. So for a couple of years, Norma had sponsored me in Toronto. And I called Norma and I was complaining. And she said, "Well, do you need the money that badly? And do you need to do this?" And I said, "I need to do this until I retire." And she said, "Well, I don't think it's a good thing. I think you should leave. I don't think you should be..." I didn't listen to her. So after about 4 years of this, one morning, you know, we get in fit spiritual condition. I get in fit spiritual condition so I don't do what Moby Dick and Moby Dick, go and knock people's hats off and, you know. I got to be in fit spiritual condition for the day to go out into the world, because my problem has always been my relationship to the world, this relationship with other people. So one morning, I guess I was not in fit spiritual condition. And as I walked in the door, she threw a file at me. And it was just her and I in the office. And I said, "God, I'll see you when I come out." And I closed the door. And I took her inventory from when she was born. And I lost it. I had a rage that I had no idea was still inside of me at 27, 28 years of sobriety. You know that terrible, overwhelming rage? And it lasted a few minutes. And when I finished, she was cowering in her chair. And she said, "I think you should go home now. You're not feeling well." I said to her, "You go home. I've got work to do." Because I just couldn't move. I was so shocked at myself. She ran out the door. And I started to weep. And I got down on my knees and I asked God to forgive me for treating one of his kids like that. I was so ashamed. And I got on the phone to Norma and I told her what happened. And she said, I told you. "Didn't I tell you? You're always staying in relationships past the expiry date." She said, "I want you to go in tomorrow and make amends and give her a week's notice." And I was ashamed. I really didn't want to go in. I wanted to just walk out, never face her again, because I'm ashamed. But I realized I had to do it or I'd live with it. So I went in the next day and I made amends and gave her a week's notice. And then Norma said, "I think you've got to do a fourth on that rage. Because that's something that you've obviously had in there for a long time." So I did. I did an intensive fourth on rage and fear. Because it was fear that had generated the rage. And I realized that it had its genesis. When I looked at it, it had its genesis in something that had happened to me long ago, either real or imagined, that had made me feel the way that woman made me feel, like I was worth nothing, hopeless, under her control. So it was a reason for me to do another fourth and fifth. And I'm so grateful that I have had the guidance that I needed to do this. What this walk has been about for me up until step six, and then of course going through the rest of the steps, is that God not only released me from the obsession to drink, He has released me from the defects of character that I had developed because of my inadequacy of living in the world, where I thought I always had to have an edge. That thing where I'll go into a room and if somebody doesn't look at me properly, they'll make me feel less than. That thing where I want to control how you talk to me and how you look at me and how you smile at me. That childish sensitivity that one day, just because you don't say yes to me, I'm going to obsess about you for 3 days. That incredible sick relationship to the world I have, where one day if I'm not feeling right and I'm having a spiritual bad hair day, I'll go into the supermarket and tell people they're in the wrong line. Because I'm projecting. To be free of that, to be free of telling my children how they should live their lives, to be free to allow them to be who they are. That is what I get from doing all of this stuff, because now I know myself. Now I know what I am capable of. Now I know that I never want to be that human being again. I know that without God I am nothing. I know that God has done for me what I could not do for myself. I know that God has recovered me from a hopeless condition of mind and body. I know that God has given me a way out of this entrapment in self. The self that was killing me. The self that was destroying me and everything I loved. I am so grateful that I have been given what I have today. And I want to thank you very much for having me here today. Thank you.